Special happened today. I got green lights all the way. With no big red sign to stop me. No traffic jam delay. See, I was driving over the moon in my big hot air balloon. Darkness, I hope I get there soon. It's so many things to do, so many people I need to talk to, and they've all been waiting for me. Well, I gotta make it through.
Hi, welcome. You are listening to WUSB, Stony Brook, 90.1 FM. Welcome to Uncritical Thinking. This is a program where I interview interesting people. I'm your host, Bruce Stashuk. Today I'll be talking with Riz Wan. Dr. Wan was named one of the top 2% of scientists in the world for 4 consecutive years by Stanford University. Right after this short break, we'll be back with our guest. Please stick around. A recent study published by the American Cancer Society states that of the people who are going to get colon cancer in America, about 13% will be under 50 years of age. It's the third most common cancer diagnosed in the United States. It starts as a polyp, a little abnormal growth in the large intestine, which over time could become cancerous and potentially spread to other parts of the body. The good news is that a colonoscopy could prevent that from happening, and most of them are routine. The procedure can save a life. It used to be recommended that people get there first near age 50, but the recommended age seems to be dropping, especially for people with a family history of polyps or colon cancer. A colonoscopy does require the drinking of some unpleasant tasting liquid, but that's the most difficult part. After that, it's almost a non-event, much like taking a nap. If one has polyps, they can be removed. If a person doesn't have polyps, even better. So next time you see your physician, mention it. Maybe you're due. Well, we're back, and I'm here with Dr. Riz Wan. Welcome to the radio program, Riz.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
You don't mind me addressing you as Riz or Dr. How are you more comfortable?
Yeah, Riz Wan is fine, Dr. Riz. Yeah.
I have some notes from you that you're a research fellow at the University of Technology in Sydney, Australia. Is that about right?
Yeah, this is right.
And you're in the School of Civil and Environmental Engineering.
Yep, under Faculty of Engineering and IT. Because I'm working on mostly environmental engineering side rather than civil engineering side, even though it's comprised of both civil and environmental engineering.
Now, are you also, besides doing research, are you also teaching students?
Yes.
Okay. And I like to start off my interviews because I find it most interesting to find out people, their backgrounds, and so on. So take me back to you being like a little boy, and what was going on in your life? Where were you born? Tell me about your family.
I was born in Bangladesh. My father my father was government staff, and my mother was a housewife. Growing up, I traveled a lot of places with my family because my father was a government servant, so he used to work in different places, and I used to go with them. Naturally, now,
what sort of places did you go to?
I went to many different places of Bangladesh, because Bangladesh comprises of seven divisions. So I traveled with him, with my family, in most of the divisions, except for the northmost part, which is Rajshahi. But I traveled there on my own when I was in university. So I traveled most of the places in Bangladesh, like majority of the places in Bangladesh. And growing up with the experience, I naturally fascinated about going overseas to do my higher studies. So I did my bachelor's in Dhaka, which is the capital of Bangladesh. And then I moved to Malaysia, where I did my master's. And then I moved to Australia for my PhD.
Now, were you a good student?
I would say so, because I was able to get scholarship for my bachelor's as well as master's as well as PhD.
And when you were a young kid, did you have aspirations? Were you thinking about science, or what was going on in your mind when you were a young kid?
One of my interests was cars, naturally. So I chose mechanical engineering as my bachelor's studies. And that helped me a lot understanding fundamentals of not just engineering, but also the chemistry, physics of many different aspects of many different technologies.
Does Bangladesh produce a car?
No, not yet.
But India does, yes?
Yeah, India does.
And do you have siblings?
Yeah, I have two siblings. One is brother and one sister. And they are they are in Bangladesh, and they are working. My brother is working, and my sister is not. She's a housewife.
And are your folks still with us or not?
Yeah, no, everyone is with us. My parents, my brother, sister, everyone is still with us.
Do you still get opportunities to see them, because you're pretty far away?
Yeah. Because of the technology, we can instantly contact, like the Messenger, the Facebook, the WhatsApp. It's quite easy to contact previously, which was not really that available in in our part of the world. So right now, our part, I mean Bangladesh, not Australia, definitely.
And the listeners don't know this yet, but I'm in New York and you're in Australia, which about as far away as two people can be on this planet. And it's amazing, because we're looking at each other and talking. And as much as we complain about technology, it's this magnificent gift that we have. When you were growing up, before you started getting deeply into science, did you have any jobs as a young kid, or were you just dedicated to being a student?
In our country, I mean in Bangladesh, it's really not that popular of students being working like in Western countries. So I fully dedicated my time in studying.
And that's so young people wouldn't put too much energy outside of learning, I assume.
Generally no. Not like Western countries.
Now you live in what city in Australia?
I live in Sydney, Australia.
Now the country is very big, and you and I both know other people, of course, from Australia. You do a lot of traveling in Australia by airplane, don't you? Things are too far away to just get in your car and drive.
It's quite far, yeah, because the country, the majority of people live in the coasts rather than in US, where people are staying all over the US. So yeah, definitely we have to travel a lot if we want to travel to somewhere, maybe in Perth, which is about 5 hours flight from here, whereas in Melbourne, which is the second biggest city in Australia, which is about 10 hours drive from here. So you can see quite big.
Now you, how long have you been living in Australia?
I have been living in Australia since 2015, when I came here for my PhD studies.
Do you think it's going to be a permanent home for you or not?
Yes, I have already received the citizenship of Australia.
Oh, I see that. Now, I believe you are married, yeah?
Yes.
Now, did you meet your wife in Australia or did you meet her in Bangladesh or elsewhere?
I met my wife in Bangladesh. And before I came here, and I married quite early compared to others. Like, I married in 2012, which is about 12 years ago, more than 12 years ago. Yeah. And I was 25.
Yeah, if in America, people who are older used to get married at a very young age, and that has changed. It was not at all unusual to be married at 19 or 20. And you went to Australia primarily because the university that you were going to study in was located there.
Yes. Because I was studying my master's in Malaysia when I was about to finish my master's studies. I was thinking, what should I do next? Should I go back to my country or pursue higher studies? And pursuing higher studies, like the PhD, is more attracted more than going back to Bangladesh.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. Yes.
You speak more than one language.
I speak Bengali, which is my native language, and I speak English. Not that good, but I think it's still workable. But I can writing is more of my stronger side than speaking.
Now, do you speak Arabic also?
Mm-hmm. No, I don't speak Arabic.
No Arabic.
But I understand Bahasa, Malaysia, because I was in Malaysia.
Okay. Now, I know you've done a lot of writing because I read some of your bio. They run well over 100 articles that you've published. And it said you've gotten... I'm almost embarrassed to say this number because it seems like it's an impossibly high number, but 10,000 citations for your works?
Yes, I just recently received 10,000, more than 10,000 citations of my work. I have been in research since 2012, so it's about 12 years I'm doing research. And it's I am really grateful for my citations to my researchers, so who cited my works.
I spoke with somebody that I did an interview with a couple of weeks back, and he is an atmospheric scientist. He's working on climate change, and he flies his own plane, and he goes up to the Arctic region and takes air samples from different altitudes. And when I got some information from you, I sent it to him because I think there's some overlap in your career and studies. And he said that you were quite prominent. So it's nice to know that somebody from the other side of the world is either aware of what you're doing, understands what you're doing. Now, in simple terms, could you tell us what you are doing when you, I assume you go to the university several times a week and you work and you're doing research. What are you doing research on?
To start with, I have to give some background. My research is, I started my research with biofuel research. So biofuel means mostly liquid biofuel rather than gaseous biofuels. Liquid biofuels mean biodiesel specifically. The biodiesel is a type of fuel which is produced using different chemical processes, mainly trans-esterification, which has similar properties to diesel. So my focus previously was on using those biodiesel in different proportions in our existing cars, so car engines rather than cars. So we had the setup of car engine, which we ran on different biofuels, biodiesel, specifically by a composition of a mixture of diesel and biodiesel, and then test how the combustion, like how much power is produced and how the emissions are reduced, like carbon dioxide or nitrous oxides or particulate matters. But these are the emissions which are regulated.
Let me just go back. My understanding is, you know, we pull oil from the ground and oil has an organic background, correct?
Yep.
And out of the oil, the crude oil, part of that is a heavier oil, and I think we call that diesel, or is that not correct?
Yep. Okay.
But you call it biodiesel. So does that mean you're taking diesel and you're trying to mix some other element in with the diesel? What makes it biodiesel?
The biodiesel is a special type of diesel fuel. Like it has diesel-like properties, but the origin of this is either it's not crude oil. It's the origin of this is the oil we usually use, like cooking oil, or for example palm oil, or soybean oil, corn oil. Those type of oils we convert through chemical process known as trans-esterification, and then to biodiesel, which has similar properties to diesel, if I make sense.
So you're not actually using what I consider diesel. You're making a synthetic, or you're making a laboratory version of the diesel. And
yeah,
I had a diesel car, and I know that one of the things you work on, I think I know, is the elimination of soot.
Yes.
Which is just a word for, I know when I used to step on the accelerator in my car, black smoke would just pour out of the back. And yes. I'd read articles that said it was not dangerous, but it could not have been good. Would your biodiesel, could I have put that in my car, and would my car have operated?
Yes. It can. Even if you put pure biodiesel, it will still work, but the amount of power will be less because it has lower energy content compared to petroleum diesel. But it will still work.
Is that like when they put ethanol in gasoline? It saves gasoline, but it doesn't have as much horsepower.
Yes, it's the same.
Okay, now, the question somebody might have is, why manufacture diesel when it's available? What is the purpose of using I'm calling it synthetic, but I'll just call it a manufactured diesel. What is the purpose?
Yeah, the main purpose is to reduce emissions. Like, so you mentioned about black smoke. So that's soot or particulate matters. So that's really dangerous. Like, there are different types of particulate matters, which is 2.5 microns, 10 microns, and so on and so forth. So those particulate matters are really bad for your health, so to speak. So with using those manufactured diesel, as you say, we can reduce those emissions.
Now, is primarily the goal to just make the air healthier for human beings, and I assume animals, and maybe even trees and plants, or is it to reduce the what's happening to the climate, or is it to do both?
It's to do both, because when we are producing biodiesel, we are using lower carbon fuels. When are you using biodiesel? So those lower carbon fuels definitely produces less carbonaceous emissions, as that in general the reduces the environmental burden of the emissions from our cars.
So it serves two purposes then. It's healthier. I know when I lived in the city, when I was a young boy, buses used to drive by, and I don't know whether they were using a diesel or not, but I know they were using lead. And back then, we didn't think it was, well, at least lay people didn't think it was harmful, but we find out later that breathing in lead, ingesting lead, is not good for living things. So you've been working on that. Now, can you produce enough of it to make a difference, or you're not worried about that at this stage?
Yes, we can produce enough of it, because in different parts of the world where there are plantations which are generally used with the sole purpose of producing biofuels. So once you recycle those forests, because it's primarily for producing biodiesel rather than producing food. Okay, so once you plant more trees, it naturally cuts down the emissions, environmental burden, as well as the emissions through use of biodiesel in cars.
And you said before the type of trees, but I'm going to ask you to repeat that. Are you talking about palm trees, or what type of trees are you primarily using?
Yeah, for example, in Malaysia, they use palm trees. So they're because different countries have different types of trees they rely on to produce oils, which is converted to biodiesel. So for Malaysia uses palm, Indonesia uses jatropha and those things. And generally, world is pushing towards producing oil from non-edible sources rather than edible sources like palm. So if we use non-edible sources of oil, then what happens is it reduces the environmental burden, because you need to plant trees and then use those oils that are not consumable by human. That oils are converted to biodiesel and it's mixed with diesel, which reduces the amount of diesel we use in our cars. So that's how we reduce the amount of use of petroleum diesel, as well as the not affecting the food chain, so to speak.
So you're still using conventional diesel, but maybe you're using less of it.
Yes. Yeah.
So less is better than the full amount. And
yes,
I know a lot of things we try to solve a problem, and I'll talk to you a little later maybe about electric cars, but sometimes there are consequences. By growing these trees, is there a lot of residual? Is there any harmful residual, or is it basically harmless?
When you produce biodiesel, the residue is mainly glycerin, which is used in different industries, for example, pharmaceutical industries or cosmetics industries. So, yeah, we can utilize the air, the leftovers in other industries. So that's, there is not much. Even though there are some complaints about it, because we use water to clean some of the biodiesel, so right. That water is utilized and it cannot be recycled. Right. So and that's all. Yeah.
And there's no magic answer. I mean, there's nothing we can do that's going to be 100% positive without any negatives. Now, are you still in the research phase of this, or are there places that are actually using this successfully?
Yeah, there are countries which are using a certain amount of percentage of fuel, a percentage of biofuel in cars. For example, Malaysia uses around 30%, whereas in Europe, it's mandated to use 7%. So Europe still uses 7% of biofuel mixed with petroleum diesel.
Now, are there any politics involved? I know in the United States, we started buying the corn in the Midwest, and even though it maybe was not as effective as they were hoping, and there's some residual, there's water in it that does some harm. So when the government tried to cut back, then the farmers were so heavily invested. Has it reached the point where there's political pressures in either direction, or are you pretty much free of that?
Well, biodiesel, like biofuel, when I'm saying biofuel, I am referring to bioethanol, which is produced from bio sources, which then goes to petrol, gasoline engines. Whereas when I'm telling about biodiesel, then that goes to diesel cars. So, and there are mandates in almost every part of the world where you have to use a percentage of either biomethanol or biodiesel in your conventional fuels.
Is that when they have these international meetings? I don't know if they do them every year, but everybody talks back on cutting back on damage to the environment. Is that part of what these governments are doing? They're trying to slowly incorporated into their societies?
I think almost all parts of the world is trying to reduce emissions, especially car emissions, as well as the transport emissions, as well as the freight emissions. So The part of doing that is incorporating biofuels in the system, so that we are using less and less of petroleum diesel, and then then we are transitioning to even less carbon footprint from our cars and transports, freight transports like EVs and hydrogen and so on and so forth.
All right, we're going to take a short break. And I'll be back with Rizwan right after this break. Please stick around.
Power.
Well, we're back. And Riz, I have a question for you. I should have asked it in the beginning. In Bangladesh, did you learn your English there?
Yeah, I learned my English there.
But, and your studies in Australia, working on your PhD and your studies in Malaysia, you were speaking a language other than your primary language.
Yes.
So you did your studies. That just seems like so much more difficult for a person to study this this technical stuff in another language. Anyway, that's just my thinking. When you talk about the biodiesel, home heating oil, I believe, is diesel, isn't that? Am I correct? What we call home heating oil, like oil number four, oil number five, we give it numbers. I used to heat my house with oil. An oil truck would come and fill up a tank, and it had a very, very strong smell. And I was told that that is diesel. Do you use it also for heating houses?
I am not sure about this. No, okay. We do not use heating oils in Australia because the temperature really doesn't fall below zero in any part of Australia, I believe.
Well, then let's say power plants. Would power plants use the biodiesels rather than natural gas or rather than using just oil or coal?
The power plants which are diesel-based generally use HFO or heavy fuel oil, but the industry is trying to move to biofuels because then it can reduce the emissions. So it affects when you use biodiesel or biofuels, it will reduce the environmental burden. So, and everyone is trying to get a healthier environment, every country. So, yes.
Now, do you work, are there other people in this world doing the same thing that you're doing in other countries? Or are you doing something unique in Sydney?
My research is being utilized everywhere because it's a well-established research area, and because the source of the biofuels are not similar in every part of the world, so naturally it's the fundamentals of research is still the same, but the source is different.
Well, the farms that grow the palm trees and the other type of trees, is the fuel used locally or is there a global market for it?
There's a global market. Like for example, Europe brings in a lot of those oils from other parts of the world, for example, Southeast Asia. So it's a global market, not just a localized one.
And I assume it's ships are used or are pipelines used or both?
If you are talking about from Southeast Asia, probably it's from ships. It's using ships, not pipeline, because it will be very, very difficult.
Does besides working in the laboratory, are you is there local places local to Australia where they're actually producing the biofuels and utilizing them? Is it beyond the experimental stage? But what I'm trying to say is, do you have I'll call it a refinery, but I don't know if that's what it would be. But do you have places that are producing this and using it? And has it become commonplace for some people?
Yeah, there are different biodiesel producing industries in different parts of the in different parts of Australia, for example, in Queensland, as well as in Newcastle, which is in New South Wales, which is about 2 hours drive from Sydney. And they are producing biofuels, which are then mixed with the traditional diesel and petrol fuel and being utilized in it is being delivered to different pumps. So in Australia, we have 10% ethanol fuel, which is a mandatory fuel for every pumps. You can get that everywhere in Australia. And since there is a mandate of a 5%, I believe, 5% biofuel in diesel, so that also helps.
Are there any side effects? I think I know that small machinery in the United States, such as lawnmowers and other, maybe even leaf blowers, they have to be careful about using ethanol because the water does damage. Is there anything in the biofuel that damages an engine, or can it be put in a car that's 20 years old or 1 year old?
Yeah, there are some issues when it comes to using ethanol. Particularly, it's to do with the corrosivity of ethanol. And similarly for biofuel, there are some complaints, which is also related to how biodiesel degrades in term when you leave it for some time in a harsh environment. So yes, there are some complaints about it.
And does the government, the local government, national government, do they do air monitoring where they say, you know, the quality of the air is improved, even if it's 1%, 2%? But do they do that? Do they make evaluations?
Yes, there is a index which is known as air quality index. Yes. And yeah, they use them, definitely monitor the AQI, air quality index, to measure how much the air quality has improved over time.
Now, when the coronavirus hit, did that interfere with your research? Did it interfere with your teaching? I don't know what Australia was going through, but, you know, of course, I was in the United States, so I know what was happening here. But how did it affect you folks?
When coronavirus hit, as every part of the world experienced, we had a lockdown, and we had even harsher lockdown in some states, not in New South Wales though. But yes, that affected a lot. Like, the students were not able to come and everything come to university. So what happened was everything was switched to online courses immediately, almost immediately, because we experienced in early February, late February of 2020. So our semester starts around that time. So we had to change everything to online almost immediately. So there were a lot of logistical nightmares.
Was the quality of the learning, the education, the research, was it maintained, or did you lose ground?
We tried our best, and because it's a very new experience for the students, yeah, some were not happy, but we tried our best, and I believe the teaching quality did not affect much, because we were aware of what students might feel when they are alone and they are just attending classes through Teams or Zoom. And we try to contact them as frequently as possible so that they do not feel alone and left without anything.
Where are your students primarily from? Are they Australians or are they from all over the world?
They're mostly from all over the world. But mostly from China. So in Australia, majority of students, overseas students who come to Australia is from China. And then we have students from India, from Vietnam, and Philippines, and so on.
Just out of curiosity, because I've been in education pretty much my entire life, are the Chinese students extraordinary, or are they just like every other student?
They are hardworking students. So naturally, those people who work harder will get better results.
There's a lesson in that. Another thing, besides the coronavirus affecting your work, does AI affect your work either positively or negatively?
AI definitely helps positively, because now students can get answers of almost every questions they have instantly, rather than looking for answers in Google and look for different web pages and get the other informations, rather than you can just ask AI, for example, ChatGPT or Gemini, and then they get the answer quite easily with a very great explanations. So now, which is really good.
That is good. I was going to ask you if that deprives them of going through a process, or is it a shorthand that the end results are better than the process itself? Some people think that if it makes it too easy, like people used to learn slide rules. I don't know if you learned slide rules back in school, and I understand they don't have to do that anymore, but some people believe that something was lost in the process, the actual struggle, the mental struggle. But I think you already answered that. They definitely benefit from it. Are there any drawbacks to the AI?
Yeah, definitely, because it's a very new technology. And what happens is the answers generated through AI sometimes is not reliable at all. I have experienced this firsthand. So I have seen well-generated answers, which are full of incorrect informations. So that's really, that really becomes a problem when you are learning new things, right? So you don't know what's right or what's wrong. So it's really difficult. It becomes really difficult then.
Yeah, that almost becomes a skill in itself to be able to decipher what's good and what is not good. And just for the listening audience, I hope you don't mind me mentioning this. I met you by way of the fact that we both do this thing from the New York Times every day, and you beat me almost every day. I'm talking about Wordle. You're just extraordinary at it, and I just don't. How does this guy do it? But anyway. Maybe it's just an intelligence thing. What do you think about electric vehicles? Now, some people think it's the answer. I think the United States government is even mandating at a certain year that everything or most everything is electric. But then other people complain about the batteries and the lithium and so on. Do you have any thoughts about electric vehicles?
Well, electric vehicle will most definitely be the part of mix of the energy we use. So electrical energy through battery, hydrogen energy through internal combustion, or through fuel cells and nuclear energy through nuclear energy through, for example, producing electricity for our household. So when it comes to electric vehicle, electric vehicle most definitely has its place, because for short haul transports, for example, for city driving, yeah, it's the best. But when you are going for long distances and you have to plan accordingly, like how it needs to be charged and so on, and how long you have to wait. So what happens is, at the moment, the charging facilities might not be running there. So then it becomes an uncertainty, like what will happen if there is no option. But yeah, it definitely has its potential, and it will be in the mix for sure. But when people think about that it's the only solution, it's not, because there are logistical things in the background which are very important to consider, even with in terms of emissions or energy consumptions or cost of electricity. Those are the background things which someone has to consider when they are making the choice of buying an EV. Yeah, it's getting expensive, and it's getting more expensive to buy electricity now. I'm not sure about what's happening in US, but here it's most definitely getting expensive to buy electricity. And when you are using say solar panels, then yeah, it's definitely comes down, the cost of charging comes down, but not everyone has the access to that PV cell in their house. So then you have to consider the cost of charging as well. There are lots of things.
To answer your question, electricity is, I think, extremely high in New York. I think I would shock some people if I told them what I pay on a monthly basis. And the solar panels, I don't know why every school and every shopping center in America doesn't have a solar panel, because they have flat roofs and they don't have trees growing over the roof. So, I mean, that could make a tremendous dent. But one of the problems that the electric cars had this winter, there were some very cold days, and people found out that the batteries are not nearly as efficient during very cold weather. And they also found out that cars don't charge or recharge as fast in the cold weather. So they were, I thought that probably was a real step back for the electric vehicle industry when it made the news and people thought about something. And also, people in the city can't have a plug-in right outside their house because they're living in a city, so that becomes a problem too. What is your typical day like when you're working?
Well, I teach about 2 days a week, so I'm tutoring as well as teaching. So in most days I'm doing my research, but there are days when I have to prepare for my lectures as well as the tutorials. So yeah, it's a mixture of some teaching and some research in most of the days.
And is there always research that you're working on?
Well, a part of doing research is writing articles. So yeah, some of the days I am mostly writing rather than doing the research.
All right. Now, after you write, you know, about something that you're doing, I assume you're continually writing. Is that because you're continuing to get better or different results, or you're exploring other elements?
One of the parts of doing research is you get to do your own work, and you decide on what to choose, what parameters to choose, and what not to choose, based on what your experience with that. So I can always choose different parameters for my research, and then test those parameters. So and test my hypothesis on what I'm going to get and what I was expecting, and then publish it.
Now, the recent book that you wrote, I don't know if you wrote that, if it was a co-venture with someone else or if you wrote it alone, I'm not sure. But it popped up on maybe Amazon, and it's an expensive book. Is that right?
Yes.
And
that book, yeah, go on.
That's not a book that somebody would just buy for their home. It seems to me, and you can correct me, that it's meant for people who have a pretty good understanding to begin with. So are you going to find out that there are scientists all over the world reading it?
Yeah, there are some online tools which you can use to track who is reading your work and how much it's being downloaded and how many times it's being downloaded and how many times it's being cited. So yeah, there are tools, for example, Google Scholar or Orchid or other things we can use to track who is reading, from where they're reading, especially academia. Academia is another website that tracks those. So I can definitely see who is reading from where.
And are people in a variety of countries reading it?
Yeah, definitely. More South America, North America, China, Russia, everywhere.
And the book is only in English?
Yes.
Okay. And that's become the lingua franca anyway, I suppose.
Yes.
Everybody all over the world is using it. Somebody once said that instead of having 1 million people read their book, they would rather 100 people read it if they could pick the 100 people. Does that make sense?
Well, I would respectfully disagree, because the more people read, it's the better, because it's scientific research and people should be aware about the latest technologies other than very few.
Now, what are you hoping to find out next? Are you looking for the next biofuel, or are you looking for a better percentage or ways of increasing the energy in a gallon of the fuel? Do you have specific goals at this point, or is it just to spread the news, basically, and have people start applying it?
At the moment, I am moving to a new field of research, trying to move into a new field of research. So hydrogen is the latest trend in energy research. So people are trying to utilize hydrogen and the potential issues that goes into using hydrogen. So one of my current goals is to see how the hydrogen affects the internal combustion engine parts when you are using hydrogen in a combustion engine, for example, diesel or petrol engine.
And there would be a limitless supply of hydrogen, or would there be problems with that too?
The main issue with hydrogen is the transport of hydrogen rather than producing hydrogen, because you can just electrolyze water and then you can produce hydrogen quite easily. That's one of the safest and easiest way to produce hydrogen. But the transport of hydrogen from one place to another and to deliver through bowsers is the challenge. and it's not really known, like when you are using hydrogen in a combustion engine, like diesel or petrol cars, engines, what happens. So that's also another issue, which we are looking into.
Let me ask you a very novice question, assuming my other questions weren't very novice. If we take water and remove the hydrogen, we're left with oxygen. And at a certain period of time, that water doesn't come back, right? It doesn't, the oxygen and the hydrogen doesn't reunite again once that hydrogen is used. Would the planet wind up having less water?
No, because when you are combusting hydrogen in engines, the byproduct is water. So it will naturally come back.
Ah, okay. Okay. I didn't even think of that. Is there, what do you do in your spare time when you're not working on your science? What's a good time for you?
I have two kids, and it's the family that drives me to do good work. There's the my daughters. I have two daughters, so yeah, the seeing what my daughters will see in future, what we'll experience in future, is a very important thing for me, and to make the world a better place for them, it's definitely a good start. I think it's a very good time.
And, how old are they?
They are 3 and 7.
So they don't know what dad does, I guess. If you're
not yet.
That's a hard one.
Yeah.
Well, Riz, I want to thank you so much for doing this. We have about 1 minute left. If you were going to give people some advice or tell them something that they didn't know, what would it be?
My advice would be to learn new things every day. Try to learn new things every day. Like, the more you learn, the more you understand the physical world and get the drive to do better in future.
Well, I certainly want to thank you for joining us today. I want to thank the people who listen to this program. I want to thank my producer, Trevor Christian, and hopefully you people out there will join me the next time. Thank you.
Thank you.